The following is an interview by Patrick Huber with James Gilland at his home, 6710 East Washington Street Extension in Mebane, North Carolina, on May 26, 1994. This interview is being conducted for the Southern Oral History Program and is part of their White Furniture Company of Mebane interview project. Why don't we start out the interview, Mr. Gilland, by you telling us a little bit about where and when you were born and about what your folks did for a living.
I was born in Newport, Tennessee, the county of Cook County, about 70 miles west of Asheville, North Carolina. And there was five kids in the family. And my father passed away when I was about 5 years old, and we all had to work and help my mother out because the work was right after the Depression, and the work there was scarce. It was hard to find anything to do. So we worked for Stoker's Can Factory some. We, as children, we picked beans and in the field. They had big bottom land with just field rows and rows of beans, and we picked, and that helped out a whole lot. And my older sister, she housekeeped for another couple that was a preacher there in the town and took care of the kids during the daytime. Then we, other than that, since my mother was with her, well, she drew welfare. We had a, they call it social service now, but they call it downgrades of people. But they called it welfare then, and she drew a check with five kids. She got a cash check of $26 a month. That was to pay bills with. And they had a store in town where they issued you the welfare supplies, groceries, and other than giving you food stamps to buy them with. Mm-hmm. So you would go once a week and you would get the groceries, and then you'd take the other part and buy stuff, pay bills, and buy stuff where you didn't get on the welfare grocery store. But anyway, we grew up and working together, and we moved out on the farm when I was about 11 years old, quit school. I was the only man in the house, and I had to work, so I was large for my age, and as far as height and all. Mm-hmm. And I went to work for a fellow on the farm then, from sun up to sundown, a dollar a day in my dinner. Mm-hmm. Then we rented some land then from another fellow. After that went on for about 2 years. We rented some land then, and he gave us about an acre of ground where we could have our own garden. And he paid me for working. I milked cows, 12 cows in the morning, 12 at night, before I put in my day's work. So we worked at that for a few years, and we moved back to town. We were out in the country, we moved back to town. So I got my job then and helped cutting timber when I got about 16 years old. And I cut timber for about a year. And then the fellow wanted me to, that was cutting timber for on the sawmill, he wanted me to work at the sawmill. So I worked there for about a year. And I turned 18 then, I was drafted in the Army. Mm. So I went into service then.
And when was that? What year?
That was in 45. Uh-huh. And I went in and took my basic training and all, and the war was over then in Germany. I went in May, and ended in May in Germany, but it still continued in the Pacific. And the recruiting officer come around, he says, everybody that has as much as 12 months service or has four dependents will be eligible for discharge very shortly, because the war was over in Germany and all we were going to need was occupation troops. Mm-hmm. And I sort of liked that. I've never been away from home over 50 miles in my mm-hmm. life. And he came around and talked to us and told us he'd give us, the Army would give us $200 mustering out pay, then a 60-day furlough. So I signed up in Tugent. Mm-hmm. And we had our choice in where we could pick it. In the European theater, where it'd be England, France, Germany, or war. So I picked Germany, and we went from there. I got my furlough and everything, and we went from there back to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and then they shipped us overseas. And they transferred us around quite a bit. We would stay in one place for a couple months, then we would stay in another for a couple months. And they finally wound up in the 3rd Division, so they busted it up and sent it back to the States. Then they transferred us in to what they called the Bloody One, the 1st Division. And they shipped us out in different areas, different ones, and I happened to be one that went to the 1st Division, and they shipped us to Nuremberg, mm-hmm. and me and a few others. And that's where I met my wife. She was working as a secretary in the House of Justice there, mm-hmm. which is the courthouse. And my company, M Company, Heavy Weapons, and the Rifle Company, the L Company, was the two companies were stationed in Nuremberg, and we put the security guard on all of the jurymen at the head for the war trials. Mm-hmm. They would bring all the men, all the Allied generals and colonels and whatnot in, and they'd put them in German housing. Then they'd have us pull guard. We'd have a guard walking the sidewalk in front of the house and one walking the back of it. And we'd always walk far enough where we could see each other going and coming to make sure that something didn't happen to the other one on the other line. And some of them pulled a palace guard, that's where the trials were. So after that was over, then the trial was over, then we started training. They took us out on the big German training camp, used to be the name of Grafenwehr. And we stayed out there about 6 months, and then they moved us. We'd come back and stayed a little while in a different place, still in Nuremberg. Then they shipped us back again. And then when we came back there, they moved us to Bamberg. Mm-hmm. But during that time, me and my wife had met shortly after I got into the company in Nuremberg. And we were real close. There was no separating for us. Mm-hmm. And I told my wife, I met her, another girl, and they were waiting on her boyfriend, and I walked in the streetcar, and I asked her, I said, can I see you tomorrow? Just like that, and she said, if you want to. And so we started going together then. But I went home that same week and wrote my mother and told her that I'd found a girl that I wanted to marry.
Huh.
And my mother wrote back in, it wasn't a week like I let her back. Uh-huh. She said, James said, marriage is a serious business, it's for life. And said that it's something that you ought to think about real seriously before you do it. And I took the letter and gave it to my wife, and she was my girlfriend at that time, Erica, and she read the letter and she says, James, I can't see you no more. And I said, why? And she said, because if you're going to get married, she said, she read the letter and she said, if you're going to get married, she said, I don't want to come between you and the woman you're going to marry. I said, dummy, you're the one I'm going to marry. I said, just like it. And when I said that, it really tickled her to death, because we just love at first sight, and we just really grew together. But we couldn't even get married then, because they were our enemy. We couldn't even hold hands walking down the street. It was a disgrace to the American uniform. Mm-hmm. And later on then, they passed the law then that they could get married, but only 3 months before discharge date. So we had a stack of papers, about like a citizen roll book catalog, mm-hmm. and had to have all kinds of records of hers from her hometown and from the police department and from the government there. And she was from East Germany.
Whereabouts in East Germany?
It's Chemnitz, was a town. And had to have papers from the government that her parents was not connected with the Nazi party any way whatsoever, and all this and everything. We had a stack of papers in mine as well, and birth certificates and any police records that we'd ever had for violations of any sort. And we finally turned it in, and the blood test was only good for 30 days. So we had to keep taking another blood test and forwarding it to catch up with it because mm-hmm. it would get bogged down on somebody's desk. And after about 6 months, it finally reached General Eisenhower, which President Eisenhower, he was the European commander at that time, it finally reached his office, and they approved it and sent it back to us. And then we were able to get married. But she had, being a German citizen, she had no right to any allotment or housing or commissary work, groceries or anything like that. I had to buy the stuff myself and PX or anything. And in other words, she was my full responsibility. But if I'd have married an ally, a Russian or France or English or Austrian or anything like that, well, I would have drawn housing allotment. I could marry and stay over there 2 or 3 years, and just like an American wife. But I couldn't do it with her. So we came back home, and we went back to Tennessee. And
what year was that?
My hometown. That was in 48.
48.
Uh-huh. And we stayed there, and my first daughter was born in 49. Then she was about 2 years old, year and a half old. Well, we moved to Mebane. There's a boy that lives here in Mebane that I was in the service with, and we also came back on the same boat together.
What was his name?
That's Charlie Berry. And he was working at White Furniture Company at that time. And we just come up visiting. My work had got slack where I was at, and I was only working 3 days a week.
What had you been doing in Tennessee?
I was upholstering. I started out in the frame shop. I was supervising the frame shop where we made the frames at. We had about 30 men working under me.
Uh-huh. What was the company?
It was upholstering. Overholt and Fowler upholstering.
Uh-huh.
It's two fellas. One of them was Overholt and the other was Fowler, his last name. So we... Then I tried upholstering, and I started upholstering, and I hit it off pretty good and learned to upholster real well. So we came up here on a weekend visit, and he said, "Won't you come up here?" He said, "I'm working 65, 70 hours a week." He said, "I'm sure they could use some hands." So I went down, and we went back home, and I think about 2 weeks later, we packed up and moved. But when we come to Mebane, then we couldn't find a house, so he's part of his house. He didn't have furniture in it. He just started out and didn't have part that was still empty. So we just moved in with him for the time being. What couldn't get in the house, we stored in his garage. And I went down to see about a job, and the assistant superintendent at the Mebane plant was Mr. Claude Bubb. He said, "James," he said, "I'm only allowed Mr. Bean." Head supervisor said he's in Chicago at a furniture show. He said he won't be back for a couple of days. And I said, "I can't hire you. The only way I've got authority to hire is if I have to fire somebody or somebody quits, I can hire a replacement."
Mm-hmm.
So about 3 or 4 days later, while Charlie came in, he said, "Mr. Bean's back down at the plant." He said, "You ought to go down tomorrow and see him." So I went down there to see him, and they interviewed me, and they said, "You've got a job right off of the bat." He said, "You're the type of fellow I've been looking for a long time, somebody that could do cabinet work and upholstery."
Mm-hmm.
Because the upholstery, we don't have full-time work to pay a full-time upholstery at that time. So he hired me, but said, "You'll have to go to Hillsborough to work." And I said, "Lord, I got a job, I don't care." And he said, "Well, I got a supervisor that works down there that lives in Mebane," and says, I'll call him and fix it up, and says, "You'll have a ride." And it cost me $2 a week for a ride
to
Hillsborough and back. And so I went to work down there, and we had so much work, even by myself, I'd have to have help once in a while. I upholstered and packed chairs. And so sometimes I'd have to holler for help in order to do it. And I was working 9 hours a day and 4 hours on Saturday, 49 hours a week.
Hmm.
So that went on for about 6 years. Then, of course, stuff posted that had in Mebane. He had a heart attack and passed away. Then I was transferred to the Mebane plant in July 57.
When did they open up the Hillsborough plant?
The Hillsborough plant, I think they bought it out. It was, I believe it was, I wouldn't swear to it. I think it was Orange Manufacturing before. And Whites bought it. I think it was in 40. I'm pretty sure 40. And they switched it over. It was an upholstery plant, made small platform rockers and stuff. And they switched it over and started making the same type of furniture that they were making at the Mebane plant then. So I went there in 51 and worked until July 57 and was transferred to the Mebane plant. So from then on then, I was by myself cutting, sewing, and upholstering, doing all my work myself. And we had two, three fellows that did packing. They was working working under the packing supervisor at that time. Then later, the business picked up so much that we had to have more help in the upholstering. And at the time when White sold out, we had four upholsters, including myself, which I worked on sewing machine or cut if the cutter was out. And I had a lady cut, one had sewed, and I'd help sew. And three upholsters and two chair packers. And I was supervisor of that department once it grew. And I carried that on through until Hicker sold out. But that, when Hicker bought it, they told us that there's going to be a whole lot of changes made, and which they did. They would come in when it went up for sale. They put in their bids on it, and they would come in about once every other week or so and just walk through the plant and see how the workforce was working.
Mm-hmm.
So they took over in June, and in September they laid off 50 workers at one time. They said the plant is overstocked with labor force. And of course Whites had been losing money on it, because that was one reason. The Mr. Bean, when he run it with an iron hand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean it was run and working off. But then his son took over, and Bernie, and he was really too good a guy to push somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And he let the supervisors of each department get away with murder, because they could just go and tell him they need another hand. He would just hire one without checking into it and see if they absolutely needed it. So they had people walking all over the plant, and Hickory saw that when they'd come through and was spot checking through the plant before they bought it. So it run like that until Hickory took over, and they cut the labor force down, and they finally dwindled. At one time, the Mebane plant had, my oldest daughter run a wood project in school on trees and what you make from it,
mm-hmm.
furniture and stuff like that. And at that time, the Mebane plant, I think, had about 335 workforce, and that didn't include office help or staff. The Hillsborough plant, I think, had about 120. But when Hickory bought it out, they cut it down. The Mebane plant, at the time of closure, I think, had 202 or 204 members, workers, or something like that. But we were running, they told us that Whites had never run over $14 million a year and produced over $14 million a year in sales.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say in 12 months after Hickory had it, we were pushing to 20 million. And I think possibly might have went a little over that before time went hard. And then the president of the outfit, the man that owned it, had four plants. Had Chaircraft and Hickory, which made office furniture. They had Cayley and High Point, which made upholstery furniture. Hickory Manufacturing, which made a little of everything. And Whites, which made a little of everything, different kinds. And when the president of the whole outfit was one of the Walker brothers from Hillsborough, the same Walker that had the funeral home. He was president of it, by the name of Howard Walker, and he retired. And when he retired, Richard Hinkle, which was the president of the Mebane Company at that time, was elected by the chairman of the board as president of the whole firm to take his place. And when he did that, he says, "No way will I run backwards and forwards the distance from Hickory to Mebane to look after this." So he went to High Point and set up a corporate office. Then he started pulling hip then. He pulled our financial man, Mike Robinson, up there. Then he pulled our general sales manager, which was Hal McAdams, pulled him to the corporate office. Then they took, I think, all except maybe one or two of the sales persons, the lady that was in the sales department, most of them went up there. So when he did that, why, they had already cleaned out all of the supervisors that when Whites had it, because they wanted to run it theirself, and they didn't want nobody telling them what to do, which I don't blame them. If I bought it, I'd want it. If I told you to do something, I wouldn't want you standing back telling me, "Well, I've been here 30 years, and that ain't the way that we've been doing it." So, some way or another, they were weeded out.
They were let go, fired?
Well, a lot of them were reduced to different jobs, and they just quit other than to work at a different job. Robert Riley was one of them, was reduced down from his job as supervisor to the stock room and driving the truck, pick up and delivery. And that didn't seem to mind him. He said, "Actually," he said, "I like this job better. I ain't got as much of responsibility, because when I was up there, I had responsibility of all of the workers." And which makes a big difference if a responsibility bothers you. And by getting rid of all of them that really knew how to make furniture, I mean the old hands that really knew how to make furniture, there was very few of them, which was just the workers that still stayed there. A lot of the workers quit and went to different jobs somewhere else. General Electric started up back here, and a lot of them quit and went back there. Some of them went to L. Smith over on the backside behind the cemetery back in there, and different places like that, and CKJ or whatever it is, in back there, out on between here and Broughton. So some of them went down there. They lost a lot of their old hands that was used to making good furniture. Then they started hiring whoever they could get to replace them. And a lot of them, it's just the same way today. You get people and they don't care if they can get 8 hours pay. Well, that's all that mind. So the furniture got till it wasn't Whites anymore. It was they got a new president, put him in there, and instead of a president, they called him president, but he was more of a plant manager. They didn't have a plant manager anymore.
Who was that?
And Robert Hart. I don't know where he's still here or not, but he was on the board of the South Bank out here, that new bank they just built right outside town. So they didn't have a plant manager under him, so he had all the responsibility from the supervisors. They'd have to meet with him then, and he would get to him. And I don't think, not running down or anything like that, but I don't think he was himself was qualified for the type of furniture that Whites was used to making and had the name for making. He had worked at places, Singer and different places, where they made cheaper furniture, but not the high class and high price furniture that we were producing. And for that reason, I think a whole lot of the furniture was, the making of the furniture was downgraded, because it didn't have the old supervision there anymore to say that's not right, that's wrong. It was more or less to say the faster we can get it out and sell it, the quicker we get the money in for it, or so to say. And there's too much of that going on everywhere. But as long as Richard Hinkle was there, he would come in short sleeve shirt and a khaki pair of pants, him president of the outfit, and he would go and work in the rubbing room, packing room, just like a regular worker, and show him how he wanted it done, and he would be right there, not only showing him, but he'd be there doing it. Mm-hmm. But the other father took over that they put in his place, though. He sat in his office most of the time, and sometimes I doubt if he would walk through the plant once a week. Hmm. But when Mr. Bean had it, and I was talking about he ruled it with iron hand, he would make a round, start when he'd come in the morning, as soon as the 7 o'clock whistle blew, he would make a round through the whole plant to see that everybody was on the job, that they were doing the job that they was getting paid for. And it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. The responsibility, and there was a lot of them that didn't take the responsibility for the pay, what the job called for the pay they were getting. And I think that's one of the biggest things. Well, when Hickory bought it, I think they bought it as a song anyway. They didn't buy it, they stole it.
They didn't buy it to what?
I said they didn't buy it, they stole it.
Oh.
I think it's $5.1 million or something like that. That included the Hildebrand plant, 12 acres of land right here just on the other side of me, beside Walton Lumber Company up there, and the plant in Mebane, all of it for $5 million. And we had the warehouses full of furniture, and they told us when they took over that they had approximately $6 million in back orders, and the warehouse was full of furniture. All they had to do was ship it out.
Sell it, huh?
And I mean, it was sold. I mean, all they had to do was ship it out. But that's why I say they stole it. They stole it because I think at the price they bought it at, they more or less had intentions just buying it because it was cheap and use it later for a tax write-off, like which they did, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. The Hillsboro plant sold, or the 10 acres, 12 acres of land up here sold. It was a different year, and then they finally closed maybe plant out because it wasn't running the type of furniture and it wasn't selling like it should have. And they changed the name of it a couple of years before it closed to Hickory White.
Hickory White.
In order to keep the name, so when they did close it out, they would still have the name of the Hickory plant, because at that time both plants were making sort of comparable furniture, high-priced furniture. Now, Hickory made a lot of contemporary stuff as well, but they also had some of the real high-priced lines like White and Caron.
Between the time that White sold it and the time that Hickory changed it to Hickory White, it was called White's up till the time they changed it, the name. Is that right?
And they changed it to Hickory White so that...
I see.
So when they did sell out, well, they could carry the name of the Hickory plant then.
Uh-huh.
So the furniture they're making at Hickory now, it's sold at Hickory White, but White don't even exist no more.
Hmm.
Huh. See, what they wanted, that they figured that the White name would help them stay on top. But the dealers, they also got rid of all the salesmen White had, replaced every one of them, got new salesmen. And the dealers that carried White furniture, especially if you get away from the plant, like at the West Coast and on that way like that from the plant, they may be shipping them furniture right now and they're selling to the public and they still think it's White's.
Hmm.
I mean, there's no way the customer, if you go in and see it there and said Hickory White on it, and Hickory White was the name of this plant and the other one too, well, you wouldn't know where it's made in Mebane or mm-hmm. where it's made. All you know is go by the Hickory White name.
Hmm. You've mentioned a lot of the old timers quit their jobs whenever Hickory took over. Do you know why? Why some of them left?
I think the biggest part of them left because at that time the furniture pay, I would consider saying furniture pay and textile was probably two of the lowest rated pays that we have in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you were on some kind of machine like a tenant machine or a shaper or a router or something of that sort, where your operator, maybe a bandsaw or something, where you had a regular job, that paid a higher skilled labor, something that required a skilled job, skilled knowledge for the job. Then they got paid a better pay. But the ones that run the planer and the joiner and what you call the tail man, because you have on the planer you have to have one to put the board in and another take it out. And workers moving, just working in there, and like the cabinet makers, so many of them would driving pegs, filling the wooden pegs in so they could put the cases together and clamping it together. Anybody, they could pull somebody off the street and show them how to make one, and they could do that job. So the pay, it was not a skilled pay, and it was a low pay. At the time that I went to work for them in 1951, the minimum wage was 75 cents an hour, and they were starting them off at 80 cents. They were giving them a nickel above minimum wage.
Is that what you made?
No, I was...
As an upholsterer?
I went as an upholsterer and experienced cabinet maker. I took that under GI training when I got out.
Cabinet making?
Cabinet making, upholstering, and I worked under GI training. So I came qualified under both of them when I got a job, so they started me out at $1.10 an hour. But you didn't get raises. They sometimes may go a whole year and not even get a raise. And if you got a raise, I have seen times, I don't think I ever got one that small, but I have seen them give 1 cent raise. But the biggest part of the time, you were lucky if it was 3 or 4 or 5 cents.
Uh-huh. There wasn't any piecework involved, was there?
No, and it wasn't a percentage. It wasn't like 5%. It was 4 or 5 cents.
Cents, uh-huh.
And... After 6 years at the Hilbert plant, I think I had risen from, I believe in them 6 years, I wouldn't swear to it, but I believe from $1.10, I believe about $1.23, something like that in 6 years.
So about 13 cent raise?
Yeah, in
six years. 6 years.
Then after I got up here then, I was more qualified. I mean, I qualified upholster, and if I by any chance got caught up, I went to the cabinet room and worked on something that was used, that had to be qualified for. It was part time. Then I did my own cutting and sewing. And I remember one time I went down. I really got tired working for nothing. That's just the way it was. And some of the places started moving in then, like General Electric, different places. So I went to Mr. Bean and I said, and I went down there and Mr. Bean was out that day. And I told Claude Bubb, the assistant superintendent, I said, I want to see Mr. Bean. He said, well, he's not here. And I said, well, I want to see him when he comes in because I want a raise or else. I mean, I had really got fed up. I liked my job.
Uh-huh.
And I like the people that I've worked for. And the White family has been just a good, close family. The kids and all run in and out here at home. And just like neighbor kids. Steve had three kids. He had two boys and a girl. And they were in and out all the time. I mean, we knew them that way. And my oldest daughter grew up with them and all. And I really didn't want to change job because I think that is one of the worst things that anybody can do today as a young person. I've told a lot of them that, and I'll continue to tell them, is to take a job because it pays a little more money, and for you to be disgusted with it and hate the job, and you just keep it because it's a 50 cent more on an hour or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because somewhere down the line, as you get older, that's going to finally get on you, and you're going to quit anyway. And the thing of it is, the best thing to do is start looking when you're young and find one that really interested, where you're interested in, and one that you like, that you think you can work with.
Mm-hmm.
That's just like getting married or something, somebody that you think you can live with the rest of your life. And I think a job is the same way. That if you got a job you can't stand, you don't like or anything like that, go ahead and work at it, but at the same time, be looking for one that you think you'd be satisfied at. Because I don't think if you're dissatisfied with a job, I don't think you can give a man all his day's work to begin with. If you're happy on a job, then you're a whole lot more apt to do your best to that job to try to do it right and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. What was Mr. Bean's response to your demand?
Well, he came back, and they told him an office over there, so he come over to see me. I was in the old building back behind the plant, separate. The only time that I was with him, I've always been separate from the plant. I've seen a lot of the boys come and go, and a lot of them I knew by names because I'd worked with them sometime or other, but the biggest part of them is just when I'd see them come and go. We even punched out on different clocks. We punched out on the clock on the backside, and the machinery, cabin room, and everything punched out on the clock in the front of the building. But he came over anyway, and he said, here you were down at the office yesterday. I said, yeah. He said, Mr. Bub told me that you said you want to raise or else. He said, James, he said, you're as good a worker as I've got here. And he said, I figured up your pay. So what he did, he went down and he figured up cutting was so much hour, and sewing was so much hour, and part-time work in the packing the cabin room, wherever I worked at when I wasn't over there, was so much hour, and upholstering was so much hour, and if I packed chairs was so much hour, and he had me figured up about five different jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Then he totaled all of that up. Then, of course, the lower paid job pulled the upholstering pay down, because upholstering was the best pay. So it pulled them all down. And he said, well, he said, I've got it all figured up here, and so much for this, and so much for that, and so much for that. And he says, really, by you doing so many jobs that way, it cuts your high level pay down to lower pay to medium grade. It says you're actually, the way I got it figured, you're 15 cents overpaid now, an hour. But he said, I'm going to give you a nickel raise because I think you're worth it.
And were you happy with the nickel?
Oh, yeah, I took it. And I went, oh, well, a nickel at that time, that was pretty good. That wasn't too long after I moved to the Maverick plant. That was probably in the late 50s, somewhere, maybe around 60 or somewhere like that. But Hickory did me, as far as pay was concerned, when they got rid of the other supervisors one way or the other, whether they quit or cut them to regular work instead of supervisor, whatever they did, on different ones of them. Well, Richard told me, he said, this is your department. I'm satisfied with your department, the way it's run. And you're going to still be in charge of it. There's nobody going to tell you what to do except me. He said, you work under me. There won't be nobody telling you what to do. And then he moved me to the clone store building, which is across the street. That big building sits in the concrete all the way around it over there. It used to be a clone store building. Clone store there. And he got me in there, and I got... he told me to go over there when he was talking about moving me. He said, I got the electrician coming, and I got a carpenter coming. I want you to go over there and show both of them where you want your cloth racks built for your cloth. Well, we carried inventory, good gracious, probably times maybe $10,000 to $15,000 worth of material.
Mm-hmm.
And all we upholstered was dining room chairs, which took an average of half or three quarter of a yard per chair. And so, and they said, we got an electrician coming. Go and show them where you're going to set your sewing machines. I had two sewing machines, and said, if you need any lights changed, see the shop manager, and said he'll get somebody to go over and change the lights for you so you'll have them in the right place now. So I come back from my office one day. I was going in and out of the office sometimes two or three times a day, carrying orders and checking orders and things like that. So I come back by him one day, and he was in the packing department working. Yo, James, I said, yeah. He said, you been over to the clone store building? I said, yeah. I said, I went over and showed him where to put stuff. I said, you know, I said, Richard, I said, we're not going to, I mean, he wanted you to call him out. I mean, that was his name. He didn't want Mr. Hinkle or anything mm-hmm. like that. He said, my name's Richard. And I know one of the boys that worked for me, him and Mr. Howard before he retired come through, and this boy said, well, he was about 30 years old. He said, good morning, Mr. Howard. He looked around at him. He said, Mr. Howard's dead. He said, my name's Howard. Howard. He said, Mr. Walker. And he said, Mr. Walker did. Said, my name is Howard. His first name was Howard. So Richard was the same way. Mm-hmm. So I said, Richard, I said, we won't have the room over to put chairs, because I had the building there where it's at. I had the hole upstairs at 50 feet wide and 150 feet long. I had the second floor where it was the same thing, where I had all of my packing equipment, my cloth racks, and one area cut off where when we'd get the chairs packed, we'd push them out and stack them up in sets, ready for shipment, and then the shipping clerk would come and pick them up. So I used that floor and the floor underneath us. I had it all for chairs. So I said, ain't no way in the world we'd get all our chairs over there. Richard just raised up from where he sort of stooped over, helping to rub some table leaves and stuff there, and walked over closer to me, just laid his arm around my neck and up on my shoulder. He said, James, he said, just do as I tell you, and he said, we'll get along fine. I said, yes, sir. I said, you're the boss. I said, I wasn't trying to tell you what to do. I said, we've got a whole lot of chairs over where you realize or not. He said, we'll put over there the ones that we sell the most of. And he said, any overstock, said we can still keep it over here in the old building. Mm-hmm. He said, I just want you to have a more decent place to work than what you have in that thing. It's cold as dickens in the wintertime and hot in the summer. And we had it fenced off, probably area about as big as the house here. We had an electric heater in there to heat it in the wintertime, but you had to go in and out the doors to get the chairs. And up and down the conveyor belt, had a conveyor belt that went four stories high. Mm-hmm. Up and down, and then you just load the chairs on. You just take them off whatever floor you come to that you wanted. You want to take them off on that way.
This is the new building, the clothing?
No, that was an old building.
Oh, the old building.
Where was that? So, no, the old clone store building, that's just one story high. Which was. It was a much better place to work. And I appreciate that. But he was real good to me. I had no complaints. Him whatsoever. And I got over there and he told me, he said, you can work however you want to. As long as you've got work, you work. You don't have to come and ask me if you got orders to fill. If you need to work a Saturday morning for cleaning up or something like that, he said, that's perfect. All right, you don't have to get permission to do it. He said, of course, I don't want you to come in and just hang around if you ain't got nothing to do. And I said, well, you don't have to worry about that. I ain't going to do that. So I built new racks on one wall, all the way down one wall to probably about as long as this room here to put extra seats and stuff we had made and things that way to get them off the floor we had moved and all. And he come over and a day or two later and looked at it, was in there and seen it. He went back over there and told the fellow that Mike Robinson, he said, go over there and get James and his crew and take them out for lunch. He said, instead of taking 45 minutes, we'll take you a full hour. And said, take him out and buy him lunch. So he took us down here, Hughes Fish House. Mm-hmm. And we sat down and laughed and talked and had lunch. And he did that way about three or four different times that way. If we done hit a high mark in sales and shipment and turned out the chairs to make a high mark in shipment that way, well he would take me, my department and the shipping department both out for free lunches. And I mean, you couldn't ask them to treat any better. But once they moved him out, it was all a new ball game then. It was just changed off completely.
Who did you say they replaced him with?
Robert Hart.
Robert Hart. Mm. Mm. Did he?
Well, they replaced Richard with Mike Robinson. He was a financial man, and also Richard vice president. So when Richard moved first, he left Mike in charge, then as soon as he got situated in High Point, then he moved him and Hal McAdams to High Point with him. And then when he did that, then they had to hire somebody to take the place.
And that's when they got Robert Hart. Mm-hmm. Did the new supervisors who came in under Hickory, did they let you call them by their first names?
Oh, yeah. They
did.
There wasn't anybody came in like that, but that required you to call a mister or anything like that. Because most of them was country people. I mean, there wasn't, a lot of people say city slickers, but I mean, people from the city where you would call somebody by their last name or Mr. So-and-so or something like that. Most everybody was called by their first name. Mm. Now some of the people had respect. Now, I would say maybe more of the black people than the white would out of respect for the white people, I think. They would call a lot of the white people Mr. I know even Robert Riley would call me Mr. James. And we had a truck driver there, Rudolph Johnson, and he'd call me Mr. James all the time. Hmm. But they'd call you Mr. by your first name instead of like Mr. Gillen that way. A lot of the colored people.
When did black workers first start working in the plant?
I don't know that, because they were a lot of black ones when I came in 51.
Really?
Now, in some of the southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, the black people, I really don't understand what they thought they would get out of life. The ones that would go to school for an education, because when they get it, they wouldn't have nothing that they'd do that nobody'd hire. Mm-hmm. And they'd go through high school, and when they graduated from high school, we had a high school there, and my wife went down and talked to him. He'd come up there and asked my wife if she would mind going down and giving him a lecture on Germany and Europe, and she did, and they were all tickled to death that somebody white was willing to do such a thing. But